You're listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
Oh, Eric D. Snyder and Jeff Bayer. They'll see all the movies to tell you which you should watch later. You have seen as many movies as these two. So they'll know the right way to steer you. Movie BS is what I suggest when you're planning a cinema night.
Hello and welcome to Movie BS with Baron Snyder, the only movie podcast on the internet. I am your host, Jeff Baer. This is my co-host, Eric D. Snyder.
Hello, welcome to the show. I'm Eric D. Snyder. That's Jeff Baer. We're brought to you by OneOfUs.net, and it's our special Fantastic Fest show. Woo! This is my Fantastic Fest woo. The show, by the way, the show is a little later today. It's almost like we're doing it live.
Almost.
We wanted to wait until we'd seen everything we could and scheduling and things, so we're doing this like Friday morning instead of like Wednesday or Thursday. So it's almost as though we're doing a show live, like the old days.
And it'll be chaotic. You'll hear a lot of flaws. You'll hear my audio be less than perfect. This is life, people. We got to move on. We got to do what we can to make a go of it in this crazy mixed up movie world.
And we have an iTunes review to start, as always.
Let's do it.
This is, I don't know who this is by because the name has letters and numbers, like the kids do now with their screen names, the letters and their numbers.
Pronounce
I don't know.
It.
Boykin? B0YK3N? anyway, he says, it's rare to hear spoiler-free reviews. Thanks, Eric and Jeff, for keeping reviews spoiler-free. Their reviews are generally to the point and let you know how you might feel if you saw the same movie they did after viewing said film. Keep it up. That's an order. Signed, a casual fan, .. That's ominous when you end with ..
It is. Maybe we have a stalker.
I hope so. Thanks.
It would be nice.
Thank you, B0YK3N, if that is your real name. And now, Fantastic Fest. We don't know anything about the movies that are opening in theaters this week.
No, nothing. We'll try our best to squeeze it in at some point in our life.
Tom Cruise is in one of them. I know that. And there's a remake of Flatliners that they didn't screen for press and didn't even do Thursday night showings like they usually do.
And Battle of the Sexes.
I guess it goes wide this week. Yeah. Those are movies that we have not seen because we've been at Fantastic Fest. And we're going to tell you now about some of the movies.
And that's our show.
There we go. Oh. We're going to tell you about some of the movies we saw at Fantastic Fest. And I think we should begin by reviewing the ones that we said we were looking forward to. We should close that
loop. Sounds good. Makes sense. Sure.
Yeah. Don't want to leave that hanging. And first of those, it was these. I think this is one of the ones you cited that you were looking forward to, though I was as well. And it's The Square. The Square. By Ruben Östlund, same man who made Force Majeure a few years ago, which is a very uncomfortable and funny comedy about a marriage and an avalanche and a ski trip.
That's right.
And now his next film, The Square, is very different from that.
It is. It's also longer.
It is. It's 2 hours, 22 minutes long, and it's a movie about art and about the way that people interact with art and about social spaces and a lot of those things.
It's a movie with a lot of vignettes is how I decided to take
vignettes.
It. Well, they all might have a tone to them or a higher purpose to them, a connective thread, if you will. For me, it was just like, all right, well, This is a scene I'll sit through, and there's something else happening, and then oh look, it's Elizabeth Moss, and then suddenly there's a chimp, and there's also somebody pretending to be a chimp, and you know it's a movie like that.
Sure, it's like that. it concerns a man named Christian in Stockholm who is in charge of an art museum. He's very stylish, modern. He's got red glasses and he wears scarves, very stylish. And
he's got great hair.
He does have great hair.
I think I'm going to try to mimic his hair. It's a different color, but that's what I mainly took away from this movie is I want this guy's hair.
And they've got a new exhibit coming up, and it's about him trying to decide how to publicize it. Meanwhile, there's also this business where Christian, was mugged, pickpocketed by people doing an act where they did a thing out in public and in the commotion stole his wallet. And then he goes looking for those people. And offend somebody else with false accusations. The movie isn't, it doesn't really try to tell a straightforward, cohesive story. It's more like you said, a series of vignettes, but they're thematically related. There's an instance, and it gets into like how much, what is acceptable in public, like the art between line between art and life. There's a scene, kind of the centerpiece scene, where they're at a big fundraiser, I think, for art donors or something, art people. And this guy comes in who, in real life, this guy is the second rate Andy Serkis. You get this guy to do the motion capture for your movie if you can't afford Andy Serkis.
That makes sense.
Okay. I think he was Kong. And you bring this guy in, and he comes in character into this banquet room as like a big hulking ape kind of man walking around grunting, and they had told people he's a performance artist. Don't look right at him. Don't act scared. And so people kind of go along with that. And then we see how it gets out of hand and people still trying to go along with it because they were told what they were supposed to do or not supposed to do. And it gets into all that. I liked the movie overall, but I'm not sure what it did for me. Some scenes are very funny, and then other scenes are not. It's got long stretches that aren't even supposed to be funny. But it makes me think about free speech and art and about this entitled, oblivious guy who's kind of a jerk, kind of a not very good person.
Right. And just like where the line is between art and not art.
It's an ever-discussing thing.
Because there's like a scene where something gets a little bit damaged, and he's just like, let's just scoop it up and put it back.
The current art exhibit is called Mirrors and Piles of Gravel is the art exhibit. And it's piles of gravel. And the cleaner, the janitor, accidentally sweeps up some of the gravel. Yeah, and Kristen's like, that's all right, nobody will notice. So
right.
Where's the line? I enjoyed this overall, but I would need to see it again to really have it all come together for me.
Well, and that's the main problem with the film is that running time makes me not want to see it again. Even though I'm completely with you in the sense that like there's a lot there that I kind of want to reabsorb and see how I feel about it a second time around, but I'm not going to because it's way too long.
Tough but fair. What do you give it?
Give The Square a 6 out of 10.
I'm giving it a B. And by the way, that'll be in theaters October 27th through Magnolia. Then there is one.
And if you haven't seen Force Majeure, please see Force Majeure.
You should do that. Then a movie called Apple Cart, which you were looking forward to, and I also saw. I can't say I was looking forward to it, but I did see it.
I understand.
And this is a horror film. The horror got comedy elements too. Pretty standard. The horror aspect of it is a pretty standard story about a family that goes to a cabin in the woods or something. They go somewhere like that. And then somebody,
that's right.
Somebody
in the woods.
Somebody goes crazy. People wind up dead. One of those situations. But the twist to it here, Brad Baru is who wrote and directed it, is that mixed with the story of this family and what happens to them, we're also seeing the true crime TV show that they made about the incident. So we're seeing actors reenact some of the things, and of course there's lots of speculation because they weren't there. And I like I like that idea because it lets us see the aftermath of the movie. Like horror movies always end usually the house is on fire, people are dead, we hear sirens in the distance, but we never get to see what did the police think of all this? How did this look to the cops? And so I like that concept.
I would have with that concept. The concept is really cool. I think it's called Inside Crime,
Inside Crime.
Like Unsolved Mysteries or whatever.
Right.
It's a really cool concept. I wish there was more mystery behind it. In the sense of we kind of understand something really creepy and weird is going on.
Right.
That is beyond somebody losing their marbles.
We know right away that the narrative of the police narrative and the inside crime narrative is not truly what happened. We know there's been a misunderstanding of what happened. And that's also part of the fun, is to see how things go, and then to see how those things are misinterpreted after the fact by the police and everybody.
Yeah.
I wish that the movie had been like better written, better acted, just sort of, you know, better.
Well, yeah. There's some really, like, A.J. Bowen plays the dad who's really comfortable and relaxed on screen, almost too much. Just like, I'll just hang out with this movie. I'm not going to, yeah. And then Bria Grant is the lead mom here, which I think she does a good job. I'm actually friendly with her. So it was cool to see her performance here. And yeah, there's good stuff, but overall it's ultimately fairly forgettable, the film.
Yeah, yeah. I would give it something like a C.
Yeah, I'm a 5 out of 10 with Apple Card.
And then there was Mom and Dad. Mom and Dad. Please note that both Mom and Dad are included in this movie. This is written and directed by Brian Taylor, who is half of Neville Dean and Taylor, who made Crank and Crank 2 and Gamer and one of the Ghost Rider movies. Neville Dean and Taylor. Now Taylor is out on his own, and he shows he doesn't really need help to come up with a bonkers movie with a bonkers premise and have fun with it. And this is one I think any parent could probably relate to the premise here. The premise is, what if you just wanted to straight up murder your stupid kids? Right?
Yeah.
There's a virus or something. The movie never really tells us. Something makes all the parents in either the city, the whole world, I don't know, makes all the parents suddenly have an insatiable desire to kill their children. Only their own children.
Yeah, they don't want to kill, right, only their kids. And that's part of the fun in watching this develop, in watching people understand exactly what's going on. Nick Cage is let loose. He's not in the movie a ton.
No.
He's
not the lead either. He's first billed, but Selma Blair is right. The lead. He's the husband.
Yes. Yeah. But every time he's on screen, he's naturally doing something weird because he is Nick Cage, and the movie loves that he's Nick Cage.
He does.
And so there's some fun things there.
He definitely gives some vintage Nick Cage craziness. Again, in his very in his very limited screen time. Don't go in expecting wall-to-wall Nick Cage action.
But right. It's kids and Selma Blair.
Right. It's there, and they're two kids, a teenage girl and a younger boy, who become sort of our heroes as they're realizing what's going on, and they have to defend themselves against their now crazy parents. There's some laughs in playing familiar, wholesome family sights now as horror. Like there's one early on where Nick Cage is teasingly tickling his son to death, and they're, you know, playing like that. But they uses the editing and the music to make it look like a horror thing, sort of foreshadowing. Right. And there's a great thing later on where the sight of a bunch of fathers lined up at the nursery window at the hospital to look at their babies. Normally heartwarming, yes. But now we see they're all like on the window, like trying to get through to kill the babies. Things like that.
Yeah.
And it's fun. You know, you get past, obviously you have to accept a somewhat distasteful premise. But
yes. And there's lots of cool ideas throughout. And sometimes they come together in full sequences. And sometimes you're just like, oh, all right, we're going here with this movie. That's fine. Sure.
Some children do die in the film, but the deaths are not graphic. He's trying to do like a, you know, a taboo, edgy thing, not trying to do exploitation or gore or gross us out. And some stuff doesn't quite. There's some side plots, like with the Selma Blair character who's worrying about aging, and the school teachers talking about planned obsolescence. Like these things are sort of meant to add thematically to the overall.
But
it's fun as
like
far as
you really
it goes.
Just want the one thing.
Yeah. And it's fun as far as that goes. A crazy, relatively suspenseful, thrilling, fun. Let's hide from our crazy parents kind of story. Mom and Dad. I give it a B minus.
I give Mom and Dad a 7 out of 10.
By the way,
good work by Selma Blair in that one.
Yeah, she's very good. Apple Cart does not have a distributor yet. Neither does Mom and Dad, but I'm sure it will. I mean, there's no way a Nicolas Cage movie doesn't end up at least on VOD. Now let's talk about Tigers Are Not Afraid, which is a movie and a true statement. Tigers are not afraid.
They tend not to be.
This is a documentary about how tigers are not afraid. Not a documentary. But it is about a real thing. It's from Mexico. Writer-director Isa Lopez. And it's about the real-life drug war that's been going on in Mexico since 2006, in which thousands, tens of thousands of people have disappeared. Men, women, and children, just gone.
And children are just simply not kept track of.
They don't even know how many kids are gone, yeah.
Right.
And so the movie is very, very tough but beautiful drama set in some unnamed city, shot in Mexico City, about kids. And it's from the perspective of the kids, particularly one named Estrella, who comes home from school one day and finds that her mother is now gone, evidently because of the drug gangs.
She is not prepared for this moment at all.
And
it's really, you just immediately, your heart kind of breaks for her because she's waiting for her mom to come home so her mom can feed her.
Right. It was instantly we're attached because these are children who are dealing with this. And she teams up with a quartet of street boys, little feral street urchins.
They really are.
Led by El Shine. And she kind of, they have managed to steal an iPhone and a gun from one of the drug lords. And now they need the iPhone back. There's something on it. So it's a, you know, regular people running afoul of drug lords, only the regular people are children. And what Isa Lopez does that makes it really work is she gives it a magical realism, where there are things like the graffiti on the walls will come to life, or there's a stream of blood that guides Estrella around, or little little imaginary things like that. She'll see dead people.
She has the belief that she has wishes that can be granted.
That's right. It begins in school with making up fairy tales to hide from the terrible things going on in the world around them. They make up these fairy tales, and she's talking about a tiger's not afraid. Mm-hmm. She says we forget who we are when the things from outside come to get us. We get afraid, and that makes us forget who we are. And
I really liked the film, and then I started falling in love with the film. Is it Shine? Shine? That's what they call him?
Shine.
When you see and realize his fear and his desire to be a kid as opposed to the leader of his gang, that's when it's just like, it's heart-wrenching. It really is. I'm actually surprised that I didn't cry throughout, even though many people did. But I was always on that cusp of just sitting in this sadness. Mm-hmm. But then also,
it's a very beautiful, very lyric, very lyrical sadness. And you know, tough, really rough things happen. This is another movie in which children die. That's not a spoiler. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not handled graphically, but it does happen. But it's also got this beauty to it, and the innocence of the children. We get to see them still being children, even though they're living on the street. they're using a sharpie to draw a jersey on somebody's back and playing games and everything. We really, really come to love these kids and root for them. And it's just an extraordinary, just a lovely, beautiful, sad film that I was really, really taken with. And I give it an A-.
Tigers Are Not Afraid is a 9 out of 10.
It's BS approved.
It's just so lovely and nerve wracking and sad.
Yeah. The director was there. She was delightful in the Q&A. This has not been picked up yet either, but it probably will. It kind of reminded me a little bit of Pan's Labyrinth, the mixture of death and fear and imagination and fantasy. So I kind of think a smaller scale and more urban and
like
gritty
than
that.
Minor leagues. Yeah, grittier.
But kind of that kind of idea. And it may be called, the on-screen title was Vuelven, which is Spanish for They Come Back, which the director told us her preferred title is Tiger's Not Afraid, but the potential distributors in Mexico wanted a more horror-sounding title.
Yeah. So we will let you know if and when you can see this movie and exactly what it's called, because it's one that should be sought out.
Very much. And then Pincushion. Speaking of lovely, sad things. Oh, boy. A lot of lovely sadness
at the festival this year, like, there really was.
Yeah, and in a lot of the movies, too.
Yep, that's true.
This is written and directed by Deborah Hayward from England, I do believe, and it's a short, it's like 85 minutes, relatively compact little movie about a girl named Iona, redhead girl in high school, who moves to a new town with her mom, who is, her mom's got one leg longer than the other. She's got a hunch on her back. Again, this mm-hmm. is an instantly pitiable figure. She's sweet and kind, yes. always saying thank you and please and I'm sorry to everyone, and unassuming and sweet and kind of simple in the head, and you just love her.
And Iona's her best friend, and as the movie goes along, you realize how much she relies on Iona.
And up to this point, we gather Iona has depended on mom, but now she's starting to break mm-hmm. out and trying to make friends at school, and here's the thing, she's embarrassed by her mom. She tells all the kids at school that her mom is a stewardess, an air hostess, and we see her fantasies.
A very nice, quick use of fantasy in this film. Normally the daydreams or like dream sequences just kind of grate on me and don't serve a purpose. This one's really nice when it shows up very quickly to move the movie along. And it's weird because at first it's like, well, maybe she's going to work it out with these girls.
Maybe these horrible girls are okay. Horrible mean girls that she becomes friends with and is trying to impress. Yeah.
And we realize how mean they are fairly quickly when one is like, I know what I'll do for fun. Make a tiny little blowtorch and just burn a little bit of a girl's hair.
Right.
Like right then and there, you're just like, oh my gosh, what are we in for? How far can this go? It goes to some, you know, pretty sad bullying places.
It does. And the relationship between the mother and the daughter is heartbreaking. They have so much in common. They're both, I mean, the mom is kind of simple in the head, and the girl is young, so they both, you know, are not always making the best decisions or coming. Yeah. They tell each other very childish lies, very obviously false childish lies.
They want to believe in other people still.
Yes.
I think that's probably they don't have their guard up enough, and
right.
and especially for the Iona, there's some, you know. Really, like if you have a teenage kid, you kind of want them to see this movie as like lessons on how to make sure that you're safeguarding yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is sad and very lovely. It's a very lovely, poignant film with a very sad resolution. And but very good movie. Yeah. I don't know who to recommend this movie to, though. Like if you want to go be emotionally devastated.
Know.
If that's your thing, some emotional devastation.
Sometimes you need a good cry, and sometimes you need a movie to push you there.
Sometimes,
I would say, I would say if you've, if a bullying movie that will make you sad sounds good, then Pincushion is for you. There, put that on the poster.
I give it a B+. What do you give it?
I give it an A-. A 9 out of 10. I'm all flustered.
Good grief.
This is the one that I cried the most.
That's also the one. This movie is 85 minutes long, and Jeff Baer went to the bathroom twice during this movie.
I couldn't believe it.
I couldn't believe it either.
Well, I mean, I know why, though.
Well, because
beer.
Beer, yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah.
Darn you, Drafthouse, for serving me beverages because I ordered them.
One time, the first time he came back, and something alarming was just beginning to happen in the film, sort of out of nowhere, and he's like, what the hell did I miss in the bathroom?
You did a very good job whispering to me, by the way.
Thank you.
For a theater that doesn't talk, I thought you just nailed it. I was really proud of you.
I got very quiet right up in your ear. My lips were probably actually on your ear. I'm sorry about that. But
that's okay.
And it was necessary.
It called for it. The situation called for it.
Exactly. Next up, Bodied. Bodied. By the way, Pincushion also no release yet. I don't know what'll happen.
Better.
Bodied, I'm amazed, hasn't been picked up yet. It has now won the Audience Award at Toronto and Fantastic Fest, and it'll get release, but it hasn't been arranged yet, but I guarantee it will be. And this is written directed by Joseph Kahn, who made Torque many years ago, one of those dumb motorcycle movies, and then Detention in about 2010, I think. Which was a movie I did not like, but that many people, especially many people who are much younger than me, did like. Film nerds the younger, the rising film generation really liked Detention, and I didn't.
I haven't seen it. You said you were thinking about giving it a rewatch.
I want to give it another try. Yeah.
I'm curious about it based on the fact that I trust this guy based on the film Bodied, which, by the way, I saw twice.
Oh, did
at
you
this
really?
Festival.
Oh, nice.
I saw Bodied a second time. I just wanted to make sure. I mean, all right.
That's
once
much
we talk
like
about it, I'll explain. There was another reason too, which we can get into after we talk about the movie a little bit.
All right. The situation here, it's about battle rap, which is a thing. In which a couple of people will stand there on a stage and take turns rapping at each other. It's basically like a comedy roast where it's you can insult whatever you want, no holds barred, everything goes, nothing, no such thing as too dark or too soon, like that. Except that the jokes have to rhyme, and they can be improvised or prepared. I guess if you know in advance who you're going to be rapping against, you come up with jokes. And it's that. It's about a white kid named Adam. Who is doing his thesis paper about this subculture, and he winds up getting involved and becoming a battle rapper or rap battler. I never did find out what this is called. And his girlfriend, who is also very white, they're both super liberal progressive. She is offended at the whole idea of a white kid being involved and by the content of the raps because they tend to be vulgar and mean and sexist and homophobic and whatever else, racist.
She's also vegan.
She's also vegan. I could not determine how much Joseph Kahn wanted us to hate her because she's so shrill and scolding. And yet the character, yet Adam, keeps clinging to her, like keeps wanting to be with her. If at any point we were supposed to see any redeeming qualities in her, I did not see them. And maybe that was the point, maybe not. I don't know.
I think it was a point, but it's weird because it is a movie that is it is so vicious in how freely they talk about race in these battle raps.
Yeah.
Like it's a huge part of it, whether it's Asians, whether it's a black woman. Whether it's a white guy, whether it's a black guy, whether
there's a Mexican, whatever, and anything goes. And so the movie then gets into all of those issues, all the those topics of racism, misogyny, cultural appropriation, who can say the N-word, and I love this fake outrage from outsiders, people who aren't there, who aren't part of the community, but from a distance are offended by the things that community is doing, which again was very relevant to Fantastic Fest this year.
Very relevant.
And the liberal game where liberals call each other out for not being woke enough. Like, the movie's just a series. Mm-hmm. The rap battles themselves are people insulting each other back and forth. But even the parts that aren't rap battles are basically a series of people condemning one another's hypocrisies. And it's all written in a way people don't have conversations. They take turns making pronouncements, very overwritten pronouncements, which took me some getting used to. Because it's not a natural way of speaking,
right?
But once I got used to it as a satiric, you know, broad stereotypical characters intentionally, I really liked it because it's just packed with these jokes and these funny observations about society and the way we treat all these things, and then also it's like some really funny rap battles.
Yes,
jokes and rhymes.
It's a movie that'll go to extremes too. Like it will make you very uncomfortable at times. I think.
Well, you'd think so.
Yeah, and I wanted to see it a second time to fully understand my relationship with the film.
Yeah,
because it does. It feels like people that don't see this movie are going to be upset about this movie.
Exactly.
if it makes a point in our like if it can make. A dent in our movie culture. And I wanted to make sure how I felt about the lead character because he says and does some really terrible things.
Right.
And the nice thing for me is I don't think the movie, while the movie world that this character is in, he's rewarded. I don't feel the same way. And that's really good. I think.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
For what I was hoping for with my relationship.
I'd agree with that. I think. Ultimately, yeah, Adam is kind of a buffoonish character. But he's also he's a good avatar for us, for you and me, a white audience at the outside looking in. But
yes.
I think what's so great about this movie is that people like us, you know, white people. That's what I mean. like it. But then also, I'm seeing, you know, so many people who are more connected to the material, black audience, people into hip hop and everything, also loving it. And Joseph Kahn, the writer director, is Asian. I'm seeing it's sort of
produced by Eminem.
That's right.
Eminem is one of the producers on the film.
I'm seeing wide support and enthusiasm for the movie from across all spectrums of society,
right.
Which is very interesting.
And it is the shock value. Like, that's the thing also why I wanted to see it a second time around, because there's so much shock value with this film on what they say,
right,
and what Adam says and how he says it. It is really something that you'll, you know, if you enjoy it, you're going to want to share it with people.
It's also a sports movie. It's structured like a sports movie as he becomes a competitor, with this final battle that is just electrifying with the triumphant music. And it's easily as electrifying a showdown, that I've ever seen in any sports movie, probably in any real sporting event too. So it's fine. It's a sports movie for me. A sports movie about rhymes and jokes.
Because you're thinking about getting into the game, aren't you?
I really should. I feel like this is my calling, to be a battle rapper or rap battler.
What's your name? I mean, is it just the obvious D. Snide?
That
is
was
it finally going to happen?
Someone suggested it should be Alleged Rapist.
Oh, goodness.
I think I probably won't go with that.
Thank you.
I love in the movie also, yet another thing it does, it gets into like the mechanics of brainstorming and coming up with jokes. Like we see
yeah.
in Adam's brain, he's got, you know, folders of like too far, don't do these jokes. He's trying to keep it good. And then he like gives up, nope, open that file, do those jokes.
Yeah.
And you know me about, you know, with the roasts and what's the meanest joke, the funniest joke you can make. If you're not limited by taste or what sort of things are off limits to joke about. What jokes can you make? And there's a scene in this movie that's just amazing, where we're wondering if he's going to like go all the places that he could go. And
yeah.
Yikes.
But yikes.
Oh, man.
There's definitely some yikes.
Just terrific. Hysterically funny. Full of energy.
Yes.
Bodied. I give it an A-.
Bodied is a 9 out of 10.
Whoo! Man alive.
We're seeing some good stuff here.
We are. Well, we're talking about the good stuff we saw. That's what's happening.
Did you notice that? Yeah, that's true.
You know, I saw. Do you know how many movies you saw? You probably don't off the top of your head.
I don't either. I think I saw 24 movies.
I saw about 28 or 29. I watched a few on screeners before, is how.
Oh, you cheated.
I cheated a little bit. And they weren't all good. We're going to talk about like a dozen of them. Next up. This is one that I had said I was looking forward to, so we should mention it. Top Knot Detective.
Yeah.
Which we ended up being disappointed in, but
yeah, we did.
Since we brought it up, we should finish it. This was the one from Australia that is a fake documentary about a non-existent cult favorite Japanese samurai TV show that supposedly aired for one season in the 90s and then built up this cult following, and now a documentary about its behind the scenes and all that. A fine idea for a fake documentary.
Yes.
And it starts off well enough, establishing the fake world of this TV show lived in, and the crazy guy behind it. We're seeing, you know, the talking heads giving their memories of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point it stops trying to be funny and just becomes a very well-made, very well-done fake documentary, but stops trying to be funny.
Purposeless.
It becomes like this... fictional story.
It becomes purposeless.
Yeah, I was very disappointed that it gave up on the parody and just sort of became a
because
thing.
At one point in the parody, there's almost the backstory of a sperm.
Yes, we almost did a flashback.
Because we almost go that deep
right.
in backstory.
That's right, doing flashback and flashback.
Great. You are capable of anything. Take me on a crazy ride. And about halfway through, it's like, nah, we're not going to take you on a crazy ride.
Yeah.
And it's like, all right, what are we doing here then?
Starts off putting me in the mind of those Andy Samberg things on HBO, the 7 Days in Hell, and then the recent one about the Tour de France. What was that one called?
It was
Drugs and
great
Bikes.
Great question. That's a great question.
Bikes and Drugs. And anyway, it reminded
HBO,
remind me of those things, which were great. But
they got the running time correct, and Top Knot Detective did not.
90 minutes. Oh, Tour de Pharmacy is what it was called.
Yeah.
So yeah, Top Notch Detective is a C.
Yeah, it became a 4 out of 10 for me.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I needed to walk away.
And you did. When it was
when
over.
When the movie was over.
Sure.
I only left one movie, and it was a Midnighter, and it was because I fell asleep twice, and so it was time to go.
Good call. Good call.
Thanks.
Next up, Anna and the Apocalypse.
Yeah.
This was one of my looking forward to movies, because it's a zombie musical set at Christmas time in Scotland.
That's right.
And does it live up to all those possibilities? Well, no, but be reasonable. What could? How could anything be as magical as that sounds? A Scottish zombie musical Christmas comedy.
It still could be for you, because it definitely pleased some crowds here.
Yes.
And here's what it is for me. This is what it felt like. It was an episode of Glee where they just decided, okay, in this episode, why don't we do something crazy and we'll have zombies this time?
Yeah.
And everybody looked around and they're like, zombies? Do we know a lot about zombies and how to make a great zombie movie? And then they kind of looked around and they're like, no, but how hard can zombies be? And then they paused to do every song. In other words, the songs typically don't drive the story forward. They stop. They perform. They're right. Lovely. They're choreographed. They're proper. They're earnest. The cast is really good.
Mm-hmm.
But it just stalls the momentum for me almost every time. That's for me, that's Anna and the Apocalypse.
All right. It is the kind of musical where the songs are about the characters' feelings and hopes and dreams and thoughts, as opposed to advancing the plot, which is not necessarily a fault, because that's also like 75% of all musicals.
I understand.
The songs aren't great, but they're catchy and they rhyme well. That's the thing for me, is if the meter fits and they rhyme where they're supposed to,
yeah,
then all right, you're doing your job. They're pretty straightforward pop songs. There's a really funny one at the school Christmas program that's like a parody of how sexy Santa Baby is. It's sort of an exaggerated, dirty song that was funny.
It's not that funny.
Come on, it was funny.
No, here's the thing.
I'm going to find the line right down. That was funny.
One of the things that could have really helped, first of all, really good, clever opening credits. That's nice. A basic start where we kind of just, we realize Anna's main motivation is her desire to get out of the small town, and that's it. It just stalls right there. And then we have a best friend who pines for her.
Right.
And then we have a couple of other, like, not toss-away characters, but close. All of that, to me, I was just like, all right, it's a little basic. It feels forced. It's false. There's a song called New Morning,
yeah,
where she wakes up and behind her, like she's going to school and trying to have the best day possible. And behind her, zombies attack.
Zombies
to
and me, stuff is starting to happen, yeah.
Yeah, to me, that is the start of the film. It does not make sense to like waste our time building these relationships that ultimately, I was shocked at how many times this movie wants me to be sad. Like, it wants me to, like, tear up because something happens to somebody in the third act. And no, it's not. There's too many layers already. You're not getting sadness out of me with this one. Not the way that they performed it.
And I like the characters. I like the simplicity of it. To me, it had this charming feel of, like, a really polished community theater production in a good way. I like the enthusiasm and the energy. The cast is all very game for everything. As a zombie movie, it's not a great zombie movie, but the zombie stuff is good enough. It's the kind of movie they make sure to have a scene set in a bowling alley just so that a zombie head could come up through the ball return. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's what you want in a zombie movie. I had a lot of fun with it. It kind of loses energy for me in the third act, but overall, I was still very positive on it and enjoyed the experience. And I give it a B plus.
I can't get there with you. Anna and the Apocalypse for me, it's that wavering of ultimately I'm giving it a 5 out of 10. It's
all
almost
right.
A six.
Doesn't matter what almost is. Next up, the death of Stalin. The death.
Oh my goodness. We're talking
Stalin.
About this now.
This was.
Let's talk about it again when we see it a second time and it gets released before award season.
We can do that too.
Okay.
Death of Stalin was the secret screening. Kind of an odd choice, because it's not like a horror, sci-fi, or genre film. Last year, the secret screening, you may recall, was M. Night Shyamalan's Split. So I think a lot of people were disappointed that it wasn't something exciting like that. But a terrific movie, very funny, written and directed by Armando Iannucci, who made In the Loop several years ago.
Yes, he did.
Very funny and profane political comedy. Also created Veep on HBO. And In the Loop had been an extension of a British show called The Thick of It, also about government and politics. And now this is another political movie, but it's also based on a true story. And from what I can determine, not exaggerated terribly much, fictionalized to an extent. But, and it's based on a graphic novel. A graphic novel that was not funny.
Really?
Yeah, a pretty straightforward graphic novel telling this sort of tragic, dark story. And then, yeah, Iannucci and his writers turned it into a comedy.
That's very surprising.
And the gist of it, it's 1953. It's Stalin's last couple of days alive. And then he dies in the aftermath. The masterstroke, the brilliant decision here, to use whatever actors Iannucci thought would be good and not have them do Russian accents, not have them pretend to be Russian, but just be themselves. And so, as Nikita Khrushchev, Steve Buscemi. Steve Buscemi talking like Steve Buscemi as Nikita Khrushchev.
So, like, until they put names on the screen,
right,
which they eventually do for these characters,
right,
I was just like, okay, my history knowledge is not great.
Why do the Russians have this guy from New York? Yeah,
there's an American in on this, and then, he's part of the, okay.
Then when they do the freeze frame and tell us this is Nikita Khrushchev, then it's hilarious. Like, oh, okay, I see what we're doing here.
Amazing,
Jeffrey.
It's amazing.
Jeffrey Tambor is.
Oh my God,
is Malenkov?
Jeffrey Tambor is Jeffrey Tambor,
who is Stalin's next in line. He in the movie anyway is this gullible, useful idiot. Who, yeah. Then there's also Beria, who's kind of like a Dick Cheney kind of figure, who's
Beria,
very much a grab for power once Stalin is incapacitated.
For me, it's Beria and Steve Buscemi that are like the true highlights. I mean, besides the tone and the delivery of these lines and the comedy that comes from the awkwardness of dealing with his death. But like Beria is a character that is so rare to see on the big screen. And it's simply this. He will make you laugh and you'll feel like you're kind of laughing with him.
Mm-hmm.
Then you will see how truly evil this character is and how it's based in truth and
right.
How you know this might have even been the way that he nonchalantly dealt with things. That's
right.
The thing. There are so many nonchalant moments that are steeped in history and sadness and pain. But these guys might have been wired this way in some of these moments in delivery. And the fact that he can go from that character and then make me laugh with him again is just rare and outstanding.
Yeah, what they do, it takes these horrific events, which, you know, Stalin had a long list of enemies. He had people killed all the time. A reign of terror. The movie begins with Stalin calling the radio station saying, I want a recording of tonight's broadcast, but they hadn't recorded, so they had to get the audience back in and do it again. And the guy in charge is very cheerfully, don't worry, nobody's going to get killed. Things like that. And this, I mean, I don't know if this specific incident happened, but those things did happen and people disappeared and were killed. And the movie replays these horrific events as farce, which is a breathtakingly bold choice. And it works because it makes everyone into these bumblers and it finds laughs, like you said, in the details of the Reign of Terror, like in the mundane everyday, all right, go kill this person, go kill that person kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the silliness, the greediness of fighting over power. Afterward, I'm kind of amazed that they made this into a farce, but at the same time, it's kind of that no one could have done this, say, 10 years after the fact. It needs to have been 60, 70 years later.
Yes,
and in a different
totally,
country
totally.
To where we can feel, because it feels sometimes it's like laughing at a Holocaust themed comedy or finding laughs in there. Michael Palin is in it. For Monty Python, Michael Palin is great. He is so natural in this. I want to see him and John Cleese in an Armando Iannucci movie doing these really snappy political lines. So funny.
And the fact that it sounds, from my limited research, it sounds like the death, in a sense, is fairly accurate as far as the big, broad steps that were taken. And also, what they did when they found a dying Stalin.
Yeah, the chaos of it. Like, just amazingly.
Just him being left in an office for a while, it sounds like that was accurate.
Right. Stalin's son, played by Rupert Friend, who is yelling conspiracy theories.
Oh, and then Jason Isaacs shows up.
As the general.
Like, you didn't even realize you needed more energy from this film, or kind of like a wake-up punch. It does it that well, and then suddenly Jason Isaacs shows up and takes it to just another little higher level.
The swaggering general. So great. And then also, the film tells this story, and it also, without laying it on too thick, makes you think about Brexit and Trump and, current, mm-hmm. present-day political things.
Yes.
It just does it all with such elegant savagery. Very impressed with it. It's the kind of movie, where someone's shouting obscenities at the burning corpse of a political enemy. It's that kind of movie. You don't just set him on fire, you can cuss him out, too, while he's burning.
It's good.
It's good. I definitely want to see it again. It's an A-. I might bump that up to an A once I see it again.
You just stole my... The Death of Stalin is a 9 out of 10 for me, but next time I see it, I might bump it up to a 10 out of 10.
IFC Films has it. There's no release date announced yet in the U.S. It'll be out in the U.K. In October, and presumably be here in the States before the end of the year.
It will be. There's no way that they don't want this to pick up some acting nods.
What did you say, 9 out of 10?
Yeah.
All right. Forgot we were doing it live. Doing it live! And now here's a couple movies that we will take turns. There are some that only one of us saw that we want to talk about. Do you want to talk about Mary and the Witch's Flower?
I want to talk about Mary and the Witch's Flower. It's from, I believe the studio is called G Kids, and it's a lot of the people that were in
Studio
Ghibli.
You're right.
And they've made this, and it has that spirit to it. And to me, it is the feel-good Harry Potter movie that we've been waiting for since Harry Potter was done.
Oh, animated, right?
Animated. And I'm not kidding. I am utterly convinced somebody's going to just step up and be like, can we buy the American rights? And we're going to make a live action. And this is going to be the first of five movies that we do. And hopefully that'll end up in the right hands, because all of it, I mean, there's a school. She's a precocious redhead that's clumsy and doesn't know what power she could possibly possess. There's a backstory that could easily be a prequel, and the imagination and visual effects that go along here are just great. And at the core, the story is she stumbles on a witch's flower, which is like the most powerful thing in the world.
Oh,
and she uses this power. And everybody thinks, oh my gosh, this is the new chosen witch, just like Harry Potter.
Right.
She must be this good at magic. Look how good she is. And she wants to please people because she's kind of been viewed as an outsider. So she's thrilled at the attention. With that, we understand eventually there is some dark magic going on where they are manipulating animals with the ultimate idea of manipulating a person into a next level all knowing witch thing. And it moves quickly, it looks great, and you're rooting for everybody you should. So yeah.
Good.
I was a big fan of this. I'm giving it an 8 out of 10. And again, I think there's gonna be more to come from this world. The author just kind of wrote three things way back when. And I think the other two things were made.
How about the author, author of the novel?
Author of the novel. I can't remember her name, but she made a 1960, it was turned into a 1960s Disney TV movie, one of the books that she wrote.
Mary Stewart, Moon Spinners.
This is a nice, to me, I don't know exactly what that book dives into, but this is a really nice discovery. There's something that's got some history as opposed to, here's the latest lightning jack and whatever it's called.
The version
of Harry Potter. And
the
stuff
version
like
that you saw was Japanese subtitles.
Yeah.
Right. Because there's an English cast credit on IMDb, Kate Winslet and Jim Broadbent and some others. So presumably that has been recorded, and probably how it'll be released here will be with an English dub.
Good.
Guess. All right, and then I saw, this is one of the others that I had been looking forward, Hagazusa, A Heathen's
Excuse me,
Curse.
Come again.
Hagazusa. Ooh. The on-screen title is just Hagazusa. A Heathen's Curse is implied. And
it always is.
Yeah. This is a very German movie set in the Alps in like the 15th century or so. Not a lot of dialogue, but it's a young woman named Albrun who lives by herself in a shack. She's a goat herd. And the people in the town think she might be a witch, partly because she, for example, has a baby, despite there having never been any evidence of ever there being a man in her life.
Oh boy.
Yeah, it's a little suspicious. Maybe it's a devil baby. And the movie, it's all about tone and feeling. Things are implied, lots of ambiguity. The sound design gets very loud sometimes and spooky and creepy. It's all about the feeling of it. I liked it overall. I think some of the there might be folkloric aspects that kind of went over my head as far as the old German traditions and whatnot. But it's got great tension, builds up really well, and it evokes a very powerful sense of unease. It's the first film by the filmmaker, Lucas Feigelfeld. He's clearly got some talent. I'm curious to see what he does next. It's good. It's good. It's a B. Hagazusa.
Based on everything you said, I think I would have given it a 4 out of 10.
Yeah, no, you...
Because it sounds like is it The Witch?
This movie, it sounds like The Witch, and it is.
Yeah.
Those comparisons are fair, and you would like it even less than you like The Witch, I'm sure.
Whoa. All right. Well, then it would have been a 4, yeah.
Hagazusa, by the way, the word Hagazusa, old German word, it's where the words like hag and hex come from. And the word Hagazusa literally means a hedge sitter. And it comes from in the old days when the old women would sit near the hedges that separated the land from the forest while the men are doing the garden or the farming. Mm. They're sitting there gathering herbs and stuff, and sort of came to symbolize like being on the border between the tame world and the wild supernatural world. And anyway, yeah, hedge sitter.
I just love when he does a little research.
Don't you,
for the show.
Don't you like words? So I like knowing where words come from, you know.
I know.
Yeah,
I like that you do like knowing where words come from.
And then you talk about Wheelman.
I will talk about Wheelman. You people listening right now, you might have the ability to go to Netflix and watch Wheelman.
It'll be on Netflix October 20th.
Frank Grillo stars in this. He's the Wheelman. He's the driver.
Frank Grillo is Wheelman.
That's right. Most definitely. And this is, what was the name of the Tom Hardy movie where he was in the car the whole time?
Locke.
Okay. This is Locke with an adrenaline kick because he is in the car almost the whole time. He's on the phone talking to the guys that he's doing this job for, the guy that put the job together, somebody else that's trying to dictate things, and somebody else that got out of hand. To top it all off, his daughter, who's trying to date and hang out with an older guy.
Mm.
And the way that it's done, the script is really simple and really solid.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't feel like it wastes anything. And also, it's very minimalist. Like, this is a regular guy who happens to be a really, really good driver.
Okay.
So it doesn't feel like it's a superhero. Like, he's going to take on 20 guys at once and he's going to do this and that.
Right.
It's more just the tension of being ordinary and this being your livelihood. And Frank Grillo, like, it easily, like, the biggest, best performance I've seen of his,
yeah,
as far as like putting him front and center, and very cool ending. As the movie goes along, the action revs up. I will say it's sad that people don't get a chance. Like, this is one of the things with Netflix. Netflix acquired this. I got to see it on the big screen. I think it deserves big screen because of the close shots, the power of the car, the noise, all of that stuff.
I heard other people say
you
that
guys
too.
You guys are going to enjoy it at home, and hopefully you will. But I feel, you know, it's one of those that I even thought while I was watching it, would I have, you know, like gotten up during the early glanced at my phone during this scene or something like that? And It's unfortunate because it's a movie that really can like draw you in. So turn off all the lights, sit really close to the TV, and watch Wheelman.
There you go.
Wheelman gets an 8 out of 10.
All right. And then finally, The Killing of a Sacred Deer. I saw. You did not. And you. I don't think you'll like this one either. I don't think this movie's for you. from Yorgos Lanthimos, the director of Dogtooth and The Lobster. Do all his movies have deer animals in the title? No, he also made one called Alps. And this is, it's Colin Farrell and Nicole Kidman, her husband and wife. He's a cardiologist. She's an ophthalmologist. Got a couple of kids. And they also, the Colin Farrell character, Stephen, is friends or has a relationship of some kind with this 16-year-old boy named Martin, who is, and he's played by the guy from Dunkirk, who was in the boat, who fell down into the thing and got his head hit on the boat. Mm-hmm. Remember that guy? He's that guy.
I do.
Barry Keoghan. And at first we don't know
Is his head, better?
It's better, yes.
Like, did it heal up for this movie? Mm-hmm, okay, mm-hmm. Good.
And at first we don't know what the nature of their relationship is. And we know, having seen Dogtooth and The Lobster, we're sort of braced for some uncomfortable, some deadpan violence and some unsettling comedy. And so at first I'm like, what kind of unsettling are we talking about here with this guy and this teenage boy? We come to find out that his father had been a patient of Colin Farrell's, and that his mother, who is Alicia Silverstone, has the hots for the good doctor.
Hang on. Who's the mother?
Alicia Silverstone is Barry Keoghan's mom. Yeah. Yeah. And then it's almost the midway point of the movie where the story is expressly spelled out. So it's a spoiler, but I would say it involves, we come to understand what this kid, Martin, what his intentions are, and there's difficult decisions and impossible choices, kind of a Twilight Zone scenario. And it is very funny often. Everything is played very straight and deadpan, very emotionless, which adds to the effect of like that we're watching a morality play or not quite a real life story or something. And then I wish the resolution had been less tidy or had some little bit last oomph or twist or some kind of thing to it, as opposed to sort of just wrapping up all the threads and okay, now it's over. But it's a minor complaint. I was really into it and it
is. Nicole Kidman in this?
Yeah, she's Colin Farrell's wife. And yeah, it's about family and and things, I guess, very grimly funny. And I admire his commitment to the premise because once it sets up what the deal is, it goes all the way with it. So yeah. I'm very into it. It's probably not for everyone, but I give it a B+. Killing of a Sacred Deer.
That was I saw the Wheelman when you saw that.
Ah, there you go. And Killing of a Sacred Deer will be in theaters October 20th.
Limited, probably, that. Right?
Yes, limited.
Yeah.
So there you go. There's a bunch of movies we saw at Fantastic Fest.
I saw a pile more, but hopefully they'll get release dates one day, and hopefully we'll talk about them then.
Yeah, we'll definitely be talking about, in a couple of weeks, Professor Marston and the Wonder Women, which is the story of the creation of the Wonder Woman character and many other things. Delightful film.
Gerald's Game, I can't remember. Did you see that?
I didn't, but yeah, that's on Netflix.
I believe that's going to be on Netflix soon, so you can see that, and then we can talk about that.
I believe Gerald's Game is on Netflix now, this very minute, as we speak.
Some really good coming-of-age women stories. Like, besides Pincushion and everything, blew my mind. And oh, my goodness, there was a weird – did you see Good Manners?
No.
Whew, I am looking forward to you seeing Good Manners.
Okay.
But, yeah, there is just a pile of interesting films here. And then I also saw Downsizing, so I look forward to you seeing Downsizing. Oh. So then we can talk about Alexander Payne's Downsizing, starring Matt Damon and Christoph Waltz.
That was the closing night film, and I was gone by then. And that'll be out. That comes out at Christmas.
Oh, really? That long?
Yeah, it'll be. I assume it'll be a New York and LA, and then expand in January. But yeah,
there's going to be a lot. Like, if again, if this movie takes off at all, there's going to be a lot of things said about this movie. Remember how Matt Damon's last movie got labeled something for people that didn't see it? The Great Wall. Was it the Great Wall?
Oh, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Little whitewashing going on with the Great Wall. I think people are going to decide this is like a white savior movie, whereas I did not feel that way at all.
And speaking of things that are hashtag problematic, Fantastic Fest is a 13th edition, and there was extracurricular trouble, behind the scenes trouble.
It really was.
Some controversy with some disappointing things where I'm writing something that'll be on Crooked Marquee. Wrapping up the whole thing, explaining everything that happened and all that. So you get all the details there if you want them. For us, what we want to say, it was an unusual week because as we were at Fantastic Fest, enjoying Fantastic Fest, we were also talking with other festival goers about the future of Fantastic Fest and what it is that we like about the festival and how can we make it better and make it better for the people who go there. And a lot of issues
and
came
that
to the,
that
came
consists
to the
of like right and that consists a lot of. Safety, people feeling like it's a comfortable environment for them.
Right.
That's the main focus here, because what has been unearthed is a lot of history of sexual allegations that a lot of us were not aware of. And that some of us
may have been aware of and didn't do anything about and kept working with those people anyway. There's some disappointing,
not us, of course, but
not
yeah.
us, but yes, we were disappointed in some choices that Tim League made, and everything's kind of up in the air now, but Fantastic Fest is great. Like everything, it can be improved, and the problems that were related here, that happened here, are the problems that are everywhere, which doesn't excuse them. But they're not specific to Fantastic Fest or the Alamo Drafthouse. Fantastic Fest is not cultivating an environment to promote men being creepy to women. But it could do more to prevent it, too. And I think going forward, it will. There's going to be more women involved now. It was a good watershed moment of realizing, we're not as woke as we think we are. We'd have more women programmers, more women involved. And that's all going to happen.
Or beyond women, just people that understand the right thing to do. Most companies are smart enough to have zero tolerance policies in place.
Right.
To make sure that if somebody doesn't feel safe, there's an immediate response to that.
Right.
And it sounds to me like the Drafthouse, and they need to improve on this, most definitely. For us, I think both of us are looking for an understanding of the past and an insurance of the confidence of what's going to be happening going forward.
Right. A lot of people were upset that Fantastic Fest wasn't addressing all these issues during the festival, but it's like asking the flight crew to inspect the engine on the plane while you're in the air. Like they're running the festival.
Or even when it's crashing instead of them dealing with the plane going down, they're supposed to come out and talk to us instead.
Right.
And
so give them some leeway, give them a couple of weeks to get their act together and figure things out and everything. The staff, everyone who ran the festival was great. This was all some bad decisions that Tim League made, not the festival as a whole. And I think, it started as the Draft House started as this fun thing. And they were programming movies for Tim and his friends. It was a very friendly thing. And I think it got bigger than that. It's huge now, but I think in some ways Tim was still thinking of it in the this is all just among friends kind of way. And I think that it got away from him. And I think that he's realizing that now. But it's been very painful.
I hope he's realizing that now.
Yeah,
right.
We'll see. But anyway, it will survive and be better. I look forward to Fantastic Fest 2.0. It'll be even better.
That's right.
Yeah.
What were you saying with the 13? Bar mitzvah.
Oh, yeah. Someone was saying because he has a bar mitzvah year. It's Fantastic Fest is 13 years old, so it makes sense that its voice is changing.
That's right. And even though, like, everybody assumed it was time for it to become a man, it clearly needs to do a better job of becoming a woman.
Time to grow up, anyway. Time to mature.
That's right.
And I think that is all
well,
good.
Well, you know my theory. Hmm. My theory is women should be pretty much running everything. That's my theory. Just in general. Just, like, let's give them... And let's lean that way for 100 years and see what happens.
It's worth a try. I mean, what's the worst that could happen?
That's right.
So there you go. Fantastic fest. Thanks to all the people who ran the festival, the volunteers and the staff and everybody, especially this year where there was so much extra stuff going on. I'm sure it was very difficult for them. Because they also, many of them were disappointed and upset at how things were going.
On a slightly lighter note.
All right.
I attended briefly the closing night party.
Yeah.
They had it in a hangar. It had rained previously, so they were kind of like, and some of the water had dripped into the hangar.
Okay.
So the floors were a little wet and slippery, so they were dealing with that. They had an inside this airport hangar, they had one of those big amusement park things with like maybe, you know, 20 swings hanging on it, and it can spin around.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And before the 32-piece band, before the 32-member band got there, I decided it was time to leave because the humidity factor in that I was just dripping. That's all I was doing. I was just dripping sweat, and I could only imagine once 32 musicians get up on stage and people start going crazy. Then that could quickly become my hell. And that was the closing night party, besides the free tattoos that we never sign up for.
Yeah, no, that's not the sort of thing we would do. If we're going to get tattoos, we're going to pay for them.
That's right. Oh, and I was a clown.
That's right. Jeff was dressed as a clown for a few days. We'll have pictures up on Facebook and the website.
Right?
We put some on Facebook. We'll have to do a post on moviebs.com with more of all that.
before we close,
yes,
Eric... let's see. I don't know if I could find it right now. Maybe I can. I've gotten one human being has dared to listen to the Paul Blart 2 Mall Cop.
Oh yeah.
Commentary.
Yeah.
And they left a review of it. I think I'm pulling it up right now. Sorry for the delay.
Left a review where?
I think it was on me, just for me.
Okay.
I saw
a tweet.
There.
Somebody tweeted something about it.
Yes. Okay.
Was that
there we go. Here it is. somebody, RJP on Twitter. Listening to the at MovieBS Paul Blart 2 punishment commentary by Jeff Baer is like listening to a man going slowly mad in a solitary hell.
That is exactly
so
right.
So I got one review so far. So that's nice. The best part, Rob Hunter pointed this out, friend of the show.
Mm-hmm.
He said listening. So like there's a good chance he wasn't all the way through it yet.
Right.
And he already had this strong opinion. There is that chance.
Probably so.
So there we go.
I think you pick up pretty quickly that you're a person going insane.
I think we should definitely if anybody listens to it, please tweet or email us and we'll read those reviews on the
show.
Sure. Because I never want to listen to it again. Because I had to live it.
Right.
But I do think it's amusing for people to comment on this thing that I had to go.
There you go.
Yeah.
So it's another fantastic fest. That's the end of this show. We're back next week with, you know, reviews of regular movies. Back to the old grind. Back to the usual routine. And so until next week, for MovieBS with Baer and Snyder, I'm Eric D. Snyder.
I am Jeff Baer.
Thanks for listening and good day. Thanks for listening and good day.
I said good day.
You didn't, though.
I know, I didn't say good day.
Jeez.
Let's hear it for our subscribers. Why? Because you wouldn't be listening to anything at all here at oneofus.net without them. Sure, they get benefits like our commentary tracks for movies, our weekly movie and TV news and trailer review show, The Breakfast Pub, our podcast, The Original Gentleman, with Martin Thomas, Bo Paul, and myself, Christopher Cox, and lots more, including some nostalgia and never-before-heard-or-seen stuff from our old site, Spill.com. Oh, yes, and the recent video logs and Get to Know You're One of Us crew. Lots of fun to be had there. I could try to sell you on becoming a subscriber just based on all of that. But you know what the main reason is? Because all of this is only here because of them. Or because of you, if you know who you are. Please, become one of the us. Support oneofus.net and help out a fellow geek like yourself.